is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us two schools. First, we have students from the Monroe School District. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Xavier High School. Would they stand? And thank you for coming. You may be seated. So here with a national award-winning program titled Court with Class, and it is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. They're sent briefs of the case that we'll hear, and they may engage in other activities relating to this case. As part of the program, they meet with a justice at lunch to discuss the procedures of the court, but not the substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. We have a summary of the case that we're about to hear, so if anyone would like a copy of that summary, the marshal will give it to you if you raise your hand. Right? Let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate, I should say, you will be meeting with Justice Crooks at noon today. At my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we will now go to our second case today, 2004 AP 64, Mary E. Fazio versus Department of Employee Trust Funds. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Fazio is Robert Elliott. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning to the court, justices of the court, opposing counsel. May it please the court, I represent Mary Fazio and the other members of the plaintiff class who were designated beneficiaries of participants in the Wisconsin retirement system who had benefits, lump sum death benefits that they received from the Department of Employee Trust Funds. It is our position that at all times someone has the protected property interest right in a participant's account with the DETF for their benefits. During the life of the participant, it is the participant who has that property right. And it is our position that upon the death of the participant, that right, protected property right, succeeds to the designated beneficiary. As a result of the Court of Appeals decision in this matter, however, there is a vacuum that has been created because the Court of Appeals has decided that upon the death of the participant, the designated beneficiary of that participant does not have a protected property right in that interest until such time as the designated beneficiary applies for that right. Consequently, during that time period, the Court of Appeals decision has the effect that nobody has a protected property right interest in that participant's account that is held by the DETF.
Counselor, if Mrs. Fazio would have died after her husband, but before she applied for his a lump sum payment under his account, would any amount have passed through her estate?
It's possible, Your Honor. Had she filed her own beneficiary designation after Professor Fazio died, but before she applied for her own benefit under Section 8, excuse me, 40.02 sub 8 sub A, excuse me, sub B, she could have filed that designation of a beneficiary on her own, even before she applied. If she had not done that, then nothing would succeed to her, and 8A2 provides the lineal succession of who gets what, and there's actually, and if you then read beyond that to 40.08 sub 8A1, if there is nobody in the lineal succession described in the statutes, then it goes to the estate of the participant.
Okay, thank you.
I look at this question in part as when does the benefit or the right, I guess, accrue to the beneficiary? When does this property interest accrue to the beneficiary? And in looking at the statute that you've just discussed with Justice Rogensack, if someone would die before submitting an application, if a beneficiary, a designated beneficiary, would die before submitting an application for the death benefit. I'm making myself clear. Husband dies, wife is designated beneficiary. She dies before an application for husband's death benefit. Then isn't she removed from the definition of beneficiary under 40.028B? Which says, which defines benefit.
8A2, Your Honor?
Well, I'm looking at 8AB. Beneficiary does not include a person who dies before filing with the department, either a beneficiary designation applicable to that death benefit or an application for any death benefit payable to that person, except as otherwise provided under Group 2, etc. So I'm saying that wife is a designated beneficiary under for the husband's death, but then she dies before filing the application. Is she removed and no longer is considered to be a beneficiary under the statute?
No, Your Honor, because of the clause that appears before that. And it says beneficiary does not include a person who dies before filing with the department either a beneficiary designation applicable to the death benefit. I read that, and I think the clear language is that, in this case, had Mary Fazio filed an application, well, I mean, Professor Fazio died, I think, on January 2nd, 1999. If Mary Fazio, 3 months later, had filed her own beneficiary designation with the ETF and then died a month later before she filed her application, as I read sub B, I think she would still be entitled, or her heirs, I should say, be entitled to that benefit, and then it would go, and that's a different question.
And,
if
she died before filing either one of those two instruments?
Yes, then she would be out of the chain of...
Then she wouldn't be considered a beneficiary.
That's correct.
And then who would have, during that period of time, let's say she dies 2 months after he does, during that two-month period, who has the ownership interest in the money?
Somebody has to, Judge, and I believe Mary Fazio would during that time because, one, she can, even before she files the application, she can file a beneficiary designation of her own under this statute.
That's right. And but I'm saying before either of those are filed. She doesn't file either of those in my hypothetical. So who has an interest in the money if she's not... She will not be considered a beneficiary.
Well, I guess I look at the question as somebody must have it. The DETF cannot have it. Other participants in the WRS cannot have it. The lineal heirs described in the statute cannot have it because there is in existence a designated beneficiary. The only person who could have it during that period of time is Mary Fazio, even though she's not filed anything at that point. And I think the statutes support that by the give her the right, even though she's not filed the application, she can still file a beneficiary designation. She can also file with the court under section, I think it's 40.19 sub 2. She can file a request that the benefit be calculated under a particular law before she has filed the application for the benefit. I think those are the indicia of ownership that she has. The issue that I think is presented to this court is the court has to decide who does have that interest during that interim period, who has the protected property interest that Professor Fazio had during life. And that's the issue.
Justice Bradley used the word accrue. The statute uses the word entitlement. Are they the same?
In my view of the statute, I assume, Justice Abrams, when you're talking about 40.71, I think they are the same. As our brief has said, the preface to 40.71 and then the language in subsection 1, the entitlement occurs on the date of death when you are the designated beneficiary.
And a property interest generally arises on entitlement.
Yes. That's our position here. And without that, this court's decisions in Giselle and Association of State Prosecutors and the Wisconsin Retired Teachers cases are impelled. Now, those cases did not deal with this circumstance, certainly. They dealt and declared that there was a general property right of participants, both those who were annuitants and therefore had applied for their benefits and those who were not yet entitled to their rights and had not applied for it. They had a general property interest in the protection of the funds in the hands of the WRS.
Mr. Elliott, why doesn't that holding apply in this kind of a situation? Why shouldn't we take the position that indeed there's a general property right of all of the participants in these earnings until your client actually applies for the death benefit?
Because, first of all, the statutes don't provide that the ETF has the right to use those funds during that interim period, if you will, Your Honor. Secondly, if they, I had the thought, if they did, the right that Professor Fazio had during his life, the ETF, by statute, had the right to use the interest and the income from the fund to pay its own administrative expenses and use it for public use. But that was balanced by the fact that Professor Fazio received interest for that use. When he applies for his benefit, or had he lived, he would have received interest to the date of his application. However, once he dies, if the fact is that the ETF can continue to use that property, if you will, Professor Fazio's account, earn interest with it, but it doesn't have to pay interest to anybody else as it did have to Professor Fazio during life, I think that's the instance of unconstitutional taking.
Wouldn't those benefits accrue to all of the other participants then? In other words, if they don't go to Mary Fazio, wouldn't those earnings actually then go to all of the other participants in the plan?
That would be the fact, but our position is that during life, you could not have, I think, although the statutes don't, were Professor Fazio's account used during his life without ultimately paying him any interest. I think he may well have had a claim for an unconstitutional taking, because the ETF during that time would have been using the interest, taking that interest and paying its administrative expenses and other things and using it for public use.
Well, wouldn't ETF, through the Department of Justice, obviously, claim that if they made these payments to Mary Fazio without statutory authority for doing so, and they claim there is no authority, that they would be taking from other participants? How do you respond to that? I know that's an argument that's made in the briefs.
Well, I think they do not have the statutory. They would not have the statutory authority to do that. But it does not change the circumstance that this was that the ETF has taken property for public use without paying compensation for it. I don't think that the fact that the ETF says we only acted according to the statutes, it didn't save the ETF or the state in the Wisconsin retirement or retired teachers case. It didn't save the state in the Giselle case, and it didn't save the state in the associated prosecutor's case. All of the conduct that was found to be an unconstitutional taking in each of those cases was done pursuant to statute. And if the ETF claims, and a large part of their defense here, is that they acted only according to statute, well, that's true, but I don't think that saves them, and it may save them from a claim, and we certainly don't make that claim here, that the ETF acted in bad faith. I think they were acting in a vacuum here. They simply did not have instructions one way or another to deal with this limited circumstance of that this class was in.
Counsel, this case was handled by the Court of Appeals as a constitutional case, a constitutional issue.
Yes, ma'am. A constitutional case in the sense that we were at an Article 1 section.
Yeah, takings.
Yes.
And I'm looking at page 13 of their opinion, and says it refers to the first Fazio case. And it seems as if in the first Fazio case that the court decided that there was nothing in Chapter 40 that provides for interest, and that there's nothing in Chapter 40 that authorizes the payment of interest. Therefore, Chapter 40, says the Court of Appeals, does not entitle the beneficiary to funds or interest thereon. And then previously they conclude that that's not a takings. Now, my point of my comments is this. Why isn't this case simply a statutory interpretation case first? Or is that the statutory interpretation issue gone, and that we have to accept that it's not, there's no interest payable under the statute, and therefore we have to interpret we have to declare it unconstitutional or declare it unconstitutional as applied?
I think it is the latter, Justice Abramson. The issue is not a statutory interpretation case any longer. It is simply whether it is an Article 1, Section 13 takings case. The quote in the Court of Appeals decision in this case, which in some of our writings we've called Fazio 2, quoting language from Fazio 1, is really dicta. The language that they quote in at page 13 is dicta because in Fazio 1 there was no issue of what was the source of the entitlement of Mary Fazio and the other class members to the lump sum death benefit and our claim for interest. That just was not at issue in Fazio 1.
Well, what was the issue in Fazio 1?
The issue in Fazio 1 was whether or not the plaintiffs had to first pursue their administrative remedies before they could pursue it in the circuit court.
So is it your position you don't have a definitive interpretation of the statute?
No, it's not. Not in Fazio 1.
Okay, so if Fazio 1 does not give you a definitive interpretation of the statute,
no,
is that
not
correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Elliott, I need help. This is an area that I feel somewhat uncomfortable, and I'm trying to walk through the statutes. I want to make sure I'm following everything that I should be following it and understanding this argument. I'm looking at 4071, sub 1. The beneficiary of any participant or any annuitant on the date of the death of the participant or annuitant. That seems to be the effective date of eligibility. I look at Section 3 that deals with the question of payment. So entitlement seems to come under 1, payment seems to come under 3. And you can't have payment unless certain activities take place.
Yes,
the battle here seems to be about interest.
Yes, sir.
What is the statute that governs interest?
Well, there is no statute that governs interest in this interim period. we concede that there is no statute that says we're entitled to be paid interest during the time period between the date of death of the participant and the application for the
So how does that factor in?
The interest is a factor in the sense that this, here the ETF earned interest during this interim period with Professor Fazio's retirement account after he died and before Mary Fazio applied for it. Kept that interest when she applied in November of 2000 for the death benefit and distributed her to her the principal of that account, but kept for itself the interest.
And the statutes don't give clear direction one way or the other as to who gets the interest that was earned during this period.
Yes. Yeah. And the interest in this, in that sense, Your Honor, in this scenario, which applies for varying time periods and varying dollars to all members of the class, is that the interest that was earned by the ETF represents the public use to which they put Professor Fazio's retirement account during that interim period. And that is the, therefore, the public use for which the designated beneficiary is entitled to just compensation under Article 13. I hope I've explained that, answered your question.
You've explained it. I'm not sure I get it, but I'll do my best.
These are not easy statutes. I've read them for years now. They still are difficult to read. Although analogies are...
Are you saying that any time somebody who owes you money doesn't pay, give you interest on that money, that's a taking? So just have life insurance, right? My husband dies, there's life insurance. I delay making a claim for a year. I then make the claim, and they just give me the $10,000 flat, no insurance. Is that a taking of my property?
No. And I was about to give the court an analogy, and now that I guess I'd have to say that that's not a good analogy, Justice.
Okay, why not?
Because that, of course, would be, in your analogy, that claim for the death benefit from the life insurance company would be a contractual claim and would be governed by the terms of the contract. Plus, of course, the insurance company is not a public body. And they're not governed by Article 1, Section 13.
Yeah, but this is governed by a contract, in effect, the statutes, right?
No, I think it's governed by Article 1, Section 13.
Well, it may be governed by that, too, but first you look at the statutes to see what our deal is when you guys take my money for retirement.
It's governed by the statute in the sense that the statutes tell us that the designated beneficiary has certain property rights that the designated beneficiary can exercise before they apply for the benefit, which I've argued is the indicia of ownership in that property right, in that benefit before they apply for the benefit itself.
Suppose there were someone who won a state lottery on January 1st and didn't actually come forward and ask for the money for 6-7 months. This was a big lottery, $200 million. Entitled to interest during that time?
I guess I don't know enough about the state lottery to tell you, but if there is, I assume there's no provision in the state lottery laws that would allow for the payment of interest. I don't think, and I don't know whether what, just to pick a number, say it's $1 million, what happens to that $1 million during that time period? Is it simply part of some annuity or underwritten contract that some insurer has to pay off on eventually? Or is that money actually in the hands of the state, being used by the state, being invested by the state, and earning interest as the ETF did here? If that's the case, you might make an argument, but I think you'd then still, I'm not sure you could make that argument, but you might be able to make that argument that the state has used someone's property for a period of time for public use without payment of just compensation. You might be able to make that argument, but I would doubt that. Well, I shouldn't say. I don't know that that's the use in your analogy that the lottery money is put to in during that interim period.
What's different? I mean, either way, the life insurance company that I gave you very deliberately, which wasn't state action, would depend first on the contract, right? the lottery would depend on what the rules of the lottery are. Maybe the lottery says no interest, or the lottery is silent, which makes it exactly like this, right? So it could be held in the general revenue of the state. It could be held in the lottery board's coffers. What difference does it make? It's held by the state, and they're using the money. And it's your money because the deal under the lottery is to pay you. So would that be a taking? I think that's the point of Justice Prosser's question.
But analogies are dangerous, Justice Prosser. But to follow that analogy, if I'm holding the ticket, I'm not anything until I turn that ticket in. I'm just a guy who's holding a ticket. I'm not a designated beneficiary. Nobody has me on record as owning this ticket. Nobody has my name anywhere in the lottery system.
Oh, but it's got your number, and that's just as good. You're identifiable by number, or whatever the identifying thing is.
The second point I was going to make is that I would bet in the lottery rules, you agree when you buy the lottery ticket on the back, it says you agree by participating in this game of chance, you are agreeing to all the rules that govern this game of chance. One of which is that you don't get it until you come forward with the ticket, and you have to come forward within a certain period of time.
But I don't have a choice. If I'm a state employee, I take the benefit as given to me, as a private employee does, just like the life insurance. So your position here is that it is, the state hasn't agreed to pay insurance interest. The state hasn't done that. Silent. But that it's a taking.
That's our position. Yes, Your Honor.
Counselor, if I understand you correctly, the reason you think this is a taking is because the lump sum was invested and interest was earned. And part of the interest that was earned was used by ETF to pay its own administrative costs. So the consideration that is given then is the rest of the interest was paid earlier to Mr. Fazio's account, and now you're arguing that interest should be paid to her, and they owe you interest because they used the lump sum and retained part of it for their own purposes, which is paying the administrative costs, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So if they weren't paying their administrative costs out of this, we might have a different scenario than we do currently. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, because we may then have a problem with proving the public use step in the takings analysis.
Right. Thank you.
Well, suppose they took all the administrative costs out of my part of the retirement fund.
Be okay.
I mean, there's not how can that be the distinguishing factor, that they use it for administrative costs?
Because
they're holding the money, and they have to do something with the money. It's only fair that they get compensated for it.
Well, I agree that you don't. I don't think that you need to show that the state, what the state did with the money, as long as we know that the state had the sole and exclusive use of that money for that interim period.
Right. The fact that they used it for administrative costs or didn't—that's irrelevant. They had the power.
I think that is irrelevant, although once we do know that they did use it for their own cost, that I think just enhances the argument for a public use.
How do you get a public use if they don't keep any of the money for administrative costs? Where's the public use?
Well, I guess they have had the money, and they've had the use of the money.
Well, if they don't get to keep any of it, and they have the use of it, and they have to pay 100% of what they earn to whosever account it was, they aren't in, I don't see where they're taking anything.
If they were to pay out that 100%, not only the principal but the interest earned during the interim,
right.
Yes, there would be no public use.
Right. So you have to have them use some of it for administrative costs. I don't see how you get around that. I don't see that, at least to me it's not irrelevant.
And that would not be a problem if they were paying for the use of that benefit, as they did during Professor Fazio's life.
Right.
They did pay him, or would have paid him, interest to the date of his application.
Right, and we have case law that says that they can use some of the monies that they earn to pay their administrative costs, but they can't use it for a variety of other purposes, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's why I think it is inequitable and a taking that once Professor Fazio dies, they continue to use that money
right.
and pay their costs,
right.
but they don't pay any interest.
Right. That's right. No, I understood that. But I guess, you know, I was concerned about your comments to the chief in that you pretty much said to her, well, whether they use part of the earnings for administrative costs or not is irrelevant. And I guess in my analysis, I don't know where you see a public use unless they do use some of the monies earned for administrative costs. I wasn't understanding that.
Well, I think it enhances the public use, but the fact that the state has taken your property and has it and holds it and possesses it and has denied you, well, not denied you, but you have no access to that property at all, during that period of time, I think, although that's not the case here, I think it is sufficient to establish a public use. Whether they invest it wisely or poorly or keep it in their desk drawer and do not, and just have it there, I think can be irrelevant. I don't think it's irrelevant here because we do know what use it was put to.
Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Hamblin, Assistant Attorney General representing the Department of Employee Trust Funds.
May it please the Court, I am Jane Hamblin, and I'm here today representing the Wisconsin Department of Employee Trust Funds. I'd like to respond to some of the comments that Attorney Elliott made during his argument to the Court. The first is that the Wisconsin retirement system and the public employee trust fund from which all the benefits of that retirement system are paid is a matter of contract. That contract is Chapter 40, and that has been held by this Court, beginning with the Giesel case and continuing through the Lightborn case. That it is a contract right that inures to them as a result of their public employment. It is a contract between the employer, public entity, and the employees. DETF is the administrator under the statute of the benefits that are paid out of the Public Employee Trust Fund. It has no right to those funds independently. It does not spend those funds for any reason other than is authorized in Chapter 40. And the funds are the trust fund's money. They are not the state's money. And this Court in Wisconsin Retired Teachers recognized that the trust fund does not belong to the state. There's also an Attorney General's opinion, 20 years old, that also recognized that the trust fund is separate from state funds. Once the money is contributed by the employers, it is the trust fund's money held for the benefit of the participants under the contract, Chapter 40, and does not belong to any of the employers, public employers, any longer. The contract provides expressly for how the fund's earnings are to be used. There is no vacuum that's set about how the earnings are to be used. The plaintiffs have not referenced Section 4004 of the statute, which expressly provides how the earnings are to be applied, and they are not to be applied as requested by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs also argue that it's not fair that the fund's earnings would have been applied to Professor Fazio's account as a participant account had he lived, and that they're not paid to his widow. The truth is that they were applied to his account. The only death benefit that is at issue today is what the department calls the special death benefit. The Court of Appeals called it the annuity value death benefit. It is paid under Section 4073-1C. What that provides is that if the participant, like Professor Fazio, was old enough to retire, was entitled to start receiving a retirement annuity from the system, but had not yet retired and was still working, then if he dies, and if it turns out that the benefit, which I'm about to describe in C, was larger than the ordinary death benefit, which was just the amount that had accumulated in his account. By Act 11, it's now twice that amount, but let's just say the amount that he accumulated in his account. There's a special calculation that is done. They pretend that, under the statute, they pretend that he retired on the date that he died, and that he took an annuity that with a joint survivor, the beneficiary. Then they calculate the present value of that annuity on the day after he died. That lump sum is the amount that is payable. There is no additional amount that is payable. If, however, a beneficiary receives the ordinary death benefit, that amount under 4073-1AM is the amount that was in the deceased participant's account with all the accumulated interest up to the date of the month, the first day of the month in which the benefit is approved. Now, the second step in this is that you have to look at how the special death benefit, the annuity benefit, is paid, and that's in Section 4004. It is paid first from the deceased participant's participant account. That includes all of the interest that has accrued to that account. If that's not sufficient, and it wouldn't be in this case because the special benefit, and they only get the special benefit if it's higher than the account value. So they get the very best benefit possible, death benefit possible, if their deceased participant was entitled to retire but was still working. Once that benefit is paid out of the participant's account, complete with all the earnings up to the date of approval of the benefit, then the remainder is paid out of the employer's reserve fund. So technically, and in fact, Mrs. Fazio received everything that her husband would have received and more. I'd also like to address...
And then maybe I'm misunderstanding, but isn't there a claim here that the gap from the date of death to the date of application, that there were earnings on this particular account of approximately $180,000?
The claim is that there were earnings in the fund on the total amount of the benefit. The benefit itself included earnings that were, well, I don't want to call them earnings. It's interest paid at the effective rate under the statute. That interest was credited to Professor Fazio's account month after year after year, because it was almost 2 years until she applied for it. And she received that. She simply did not receive the additional interest on the total amount because she didn't apply for it for 2 years. There was no way that they could have calculated the benefit. They didn't know whether she wanted to receive a lump sum or an annuity. There had not been confirmation that she was the right, that there was no comfort. They hadn't determined which benefit she was entitled to, whether it was the account value or the annuity value.
So you're saying that she did get some interest on the account. If we look at the account on the date of death and we look at what was then paid to her, you're saying that amount was increased by interest earned in the interim period, the almost 2 year period. Is that right?
The amount that she actually received was not increased because she already was receiving a special death benefit, which was more than the ordinary death benefit, which is strictly the account value. What I'm saying is that Attorney Elliott said it was not fair that Professor Fazio would have continued to receive the earnings on his account, and he didn't. What I'm saying is his account did continue to receive those earnings, and that it was paid to Mrs. Fazio. She didn't recognize an increase in her lump sum annuity value benefit, but it is not correct to say that she didn't receive the earnings that were accruing to his account, that there was somehow a cutoff of earnings accruing to that account.
Well, when did those earnings accrue? Before he died or after he died?
After he died. Up until, if she applied in The benefit, I think, was approved in December of 1999. It would have accrued up until December 1st, 1999.
Counselor, if I understand you correctly, what ETF did was to look at what was in his account, continue to, in an accounting way, give that account interest, and then when she applied, you determined whether giving her the account and the accumulated interest would have been a higher number, or whether a lump sum death benefit under 1C would have been higher, and she got the latter. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. She could have also elected to receive the higher amount as an annuity, but she elected the lump sum.
Okay, thank you.
But the complaint is that she didn't get interest on that lump sum.
That's correct. Her complaint is that she didn't get interest on that lump sum, which a participant has no right to receive interest that's not provided by the statute. It's not clear why a beneficiary should have rights in excess of what what the participant would have.
And Mr. Elliott is saying on behalf of his client that you're making money out of her money, right?
Well,
you're keeping her money and you're investing it, right?
I'd like to correct what I perceive as a misstatement. DETF is not making any money. It's the trust fund that is earning the return. And sometimes they don't earn a positive return. There's a reason that Chapter 40 provides for a smoothing mechanism. It is so that the participants and the beneficiaries will not be subject to the vagaries of the stock market. It's smoothed out over a five-year period, and that's how the effective rate is calculated. No one in the system is entitled to receive the actual earnings or proportionate share of the actual earnings of the trust fund. And it is not TS money, as I said earlier. It can be used only for trust purposes. That is clearly set out in Chapter 40, and it's also a tenet of trust law that a trust fund can be used only for trust purposes and that the payment of administrative costs are a trust purpose. That's general trust law, and it's also provided for in 4004, the statute.
Sam, let me see if I have got a handle on this, because this is confusing to me, and I fully admit it. As I understand the statutory scheme, even before I get there, what I just heard you indicate is that there are occasions in which the trust fund does pay out interest for the death benefits, correct?
That is correct. They pay it out in the sense that they pay what is in the deceased participant's account. And that has, under 4004 again, that has the effective rate interest credited to it at the end of every year.
Yeah, but that accrues until the point when the individual dies. Is that correct?
It accrues in an ordinary death benefit until the point where the death benefit payment is approved. So even after the person dies.
All right. Well, and that's what I'm trying to get a handle on. So under the facts of this, or at least the statutory scheme, under 4071 sub 1, it seems that the entitlement to the death benefit for the beneficiary is upon the date of the death. The payment doesn't take place under sub 3 until a copy of the death certificate of the participant or an annuitant or a written application of the beneficiary and any additional evidence deemed necessary and desirable by the party. So the payment is a different date than the entitlement. Am I hearing you correctly in saying that the interest that is calculated goes up until the date of the payment?
The interest is not calculated on the death benefit itself. The interest that I'm talking about that is credited to an individual's account under, whether you're dead or alive, your account gets credited with this effective rate interest every year. And that's what continues. The deceased participant's account stays in effect until it's closed out when the benefit is paid. So what I'm saying is that I want to be clear, her death benefit was not increased by earnings, but she did receive the earnings that were, or the interest that was credited to her deceased husband's account And she received more than that because she received the excess from the employer reserve account.
Okay, let's put it in numbers. Her account is, I'm sorry, his account was
$100.
Exactly, that's the number I have, $100. He dies. Every year you credit all accounts with a percent, okay?
Could be $2, could be $1.
All right, let's credit him, the account now. So each year you may, he, that account went up by $2, right?
Okay.
All right. Now 2 years later, she comes in and wants the account, right? She would get how much? $104 under that calculation?
Had she taken, had she been...
I know there are two ways she
could make it. Well, no, she doesn't have an option. She gets the higher. So if the higher had been the account value, then she would have gotten the $102. But to make it even more complicated, because she didn't wait 2 full years to apply for the benefit, for that second year, she only got the proportionate share of 5% for the partial year.
Okay. So she says roughly?
Roughly $102.
Okay. And in the other way of calculating it, the more the, a maximum way, you give the account credit for earnings?
In the other way, the annuity value way of calculating it, let's say that because it's higher, let's say it's $150.
Right.
That she's entitled
okay.
to.
Mm-hmm.
It's paid first from the $102 in the participant's account, and the remaining $38 is paid from the employer reserve account.
Got it. So she has gotten what everybody else got in
plus
terms
more.
Of, yeah, of interest.
Right.
And what he is asking, what I assume Mr. Elliott is asking for, is interest on the $150.
That's correct.
Or if it were the other one, interest on the $104. And your position is that account has already gotten earnings.
That's correct.
So, counsel, just so I, and I thank you very much for, and my colleagues for explaining this, but as I understand this, you've got the two accounts. At the day of the death of Professor Fazio, it is true that, and depending upon her selection, because that's one of the issues here, but if, and this is all in one big account, and we're all in it, so I'm just thinking that if the market went sour, so to speak, and there was no increase, potentially, would that be affected by the decrease, or is it always an increase for the money that stays in? And you follow what I mean?
I do follow what you mean, and it is not a decrease because of the smoothing mechanism
right.
that I described. It is... It protects the participants from those problems. As you may recall, from 2000 to 2002, the trust fund
went down.
But no member of the Wisconsin retirement system suffered a loss.
Well, the only people that suffered, if there was any suffering, were the people that were still in the plan and that they received, and they said, well, this year you lost 15% or whatever.
Well, that's in the variable fund.
If
you're in the variable fund, yes, we're.
You can see where I'm just.
Right. No, I understand.
But I'm trying to understand.
Well, and in fact, just to take that a step further, it's possible that some of the people in the plaintiff class would actually, if they are found to be entitled to the fund's earnings for that period, that they may actually receive negative earnings, which means they'll have to pay back some of the benefit.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly.
Could I ask, I don't quite understand where the figure of $182,000 comes from in relation to the, what I'm talking about is the size of that amount in relation to the lump sum payment. Did something happen? Or how?
The way it was calculated, it was a formula that was set by the trial court. And they based that on the just compensation that was found in Wisconsin Retired Teachers case, although that really was a completely different issue, but he found that that was not the just compensation. The trial court found that the right to the benefit had been taken because it wasn't paid until the application was filed. Then he found that just compensation was the amount of that benefit times the fixed fund effective rate, which was what the calculation was in Wisconsin retired teachers, because they were only talking about the fixed fund in the employer's reserve account in that case. Then the third factor was the length of time. So I don't have the numbers here, but it came to a substantial calculation, because during that time actually is when the fixed fund effective rate was quite high.
So it could have been 10% or 20%.
That's right, it could have been.
And so the benefit was over $500,000.
That's right. And this, remember, this period of time was from, I believe he died in 97 and through 99, so that was a pretty healthy time for the stock market.
So if it was 20%, you'd multiply that twice over against $500,000.
Could I ask one other question?
Sure.
We're focusing on a widow and her actions in the wake of the death of her husband. Is there any way to look at this, or is there a possibility that someone could be sort of calculating in when they apply for the benefit? Is there any way you try to play the system?
Well, it's true that if a person were going to receive the account value benefit, the longer that they wait to apply, the bigger the account will be. And in fact, there was one person who actually waited 6 years to apply, such that the account value was higher than the annuity value. And before Act 11, that was very extraordinary. The annuity value was almost always higher. So it's true. I mean, the pension fund is not a bank. I mean, people shouldn't be leaving their money in hopes that they're going to make a better return than if they withdraw it and pay and deposit it in their own account for investment. But there's nothing that prevents them from doing that. There are a couple of other things.
But just so I can follow up this precious question, that's not necessarily taking advantage of the system. Then, indeed, it is. If I'm understanding now the dispute correctly, if the person had taken the money out and invested it on their own, they might actually have gotten a higher return. Is that correct?
That's true. They might have.
I guess my question becomes that if, maybe I misunderstood this when we took it, if there was indeed a calculation that accrued interest all along, is this issue really properly before us if the interest has already been calculated and paid?
Well, I'm sure that Attorney Elliott will address that. I think what they'll say is that she didn't get any increased amount on her actual annuity value benefit. I think that she's asking for double the interest that she's entitled to and more. I would like to just make a couple of other points before my time runs out. And one of those is the definition of beneficiary, which was addressed with Attorney Elliott. And I have to dispute his interpretation of 4028A. He says that if you filed either the designation of beneficiary or the application for the benefit, that then you're entitled for your beneficiary to receive the benefit, for the beneficiary's beneficiary to receive the death benefit. I don't think the statute can be read that way. You have to have filed an application in order to be the official recipient of the benefit. And I base that on two phrases in 4028. The first is in A2, which says, if all beneficiaries so designated died before filing with the department an application for any death benefit payable, the person determined in the following sequence will receive the death benefit. And then that goes back to the participant's standard sequence. In addition, in B, 4028B, the beneficiary does not include a person who dies before filing with the department. And here's the problem. It says either a beneficiary designation or an application. And based on the next sentence, that really has to be read as and in artful drafting. But it says, if a person dies after filing a beneficiary application, but before the date on which the benefit check, share draft, or other draft is issued or funds transferred, any benefit payable shall be paid in accordance with the written designation of the beneficiary. Now, this says if they die after filing an application. It says nothing about filing only the beneficiary designation. So it says to me that they must file the application before they're actually entitled to a benefit, and that's completely consistent with 4071, which says that you have to comply with the conditions in order to receive the benefit. It is consistent with the rest of Chapter 40 benefits, which have conditions. If we do not require them to comply with the conditions to have an entitlement to the benefit, then we carry to its logical extreme, you can have a disability applicant claim that they are entitled to receive the disability as of the time they broke their ankle. Actually, for a 40, Chapter 40 disability, it's much more serious than that, as of the time they got cancer, as opposed to the time that they actually had complied with the statute of getting the medical certificates and the application in. They have an inchoate right. They have an expectation that they may be entitled to receive this. In the case of Mrs. Fazio, maybe she knew she was entitled to receive it, but she didn't know how much. She didn't know which death benefit. She had to file the application so that DETF could make that determination.
I want to make sure I'm following you here, and I'm not sure I am. I look at 8A. Beneficiary means the person or a trust in which the person has a beneficial interest so designated by a participant or insured employee or an annuitant in the last written designation of the beneficiary on file with and in the form approved by the department. That seems to be the definition of beneficiary in 8A.
If you go to 2 of A, which is also part of A.
Right. In the absence of a written designation of beneficiary.
Or.
All right.
If all the beneficiaries so designated die, which is what we're talking about, whether a named beneficiary has a right to leave.
Ms. Fazio didn't die before, right? Correct?
No.
But so how would that apply here?
It only applies to the determination of whether she actually had a property right to the death benefit.
But
had she died.
If she hasn't died, but we're talking about a person who hasn't died. So sub 1A would, or 8A1 would seem to control. She's a beneficiary under 8A1. I don't see
She is the beneficiary. She is absolutely the beneficiary. She filed her application. She received the death benefit she was entitled to receive.
Right.
What I am pointing to in 4028 is that it undermines any argument that the beneficiary is entitled to the benefit without filing an application for the benefit.
Take you back to 4071 sub 1.
Right.
The statute says the following described persons are entitled to death benefits in the system. The beneficiary of any participant or any annuitant on the date of death of the participant. Now, if she's a beneficiary under 8A, the date of death seems to control the date of entitlement. The date of payment under sub 3 is a totally different thing.
I don't see how you can have a legal right to an amount of money, a specific amount of money, if you haven't complied with the conditions to the payment.
Well, I think it's clear that the department doesn't pay out. That's under sub 3, but the question is one of entitlement. And the way the statutes are set up, the entitlement is upon the date of death.
She could not sue the department and receive a payment of that
not
death benefit without filing the application. That's absolutely, there is that condition. Okay. Okay.
Right.
But, if she has, let me carry that further, is that if she may have a conditional right. And I don't, the fact is, the Court of Appeals decided this case on the narrow issue of whether there was a property right in the benefit itself on the date of death. She did not have one based on the reading of 4071 and, I believe, the definition of beneficiary. However, even if she did, there's nothing that gives her a right to the fund's earnings on that amount. There's not, as I began by saying, it's a contract. She gets what she's entitled to under the contract.
Well, it seems to me what you're arguing is under the statute that Justice Butler read, she is a beneficiary designated as such, and she has a right to get the money when he dies. But that right is not perfected until, you use the word conditional, that right really isn't perfected until she either files her own designation or she applies. And if she doesn't do that and she dies, it's gone.
Well, that's correct, and I would argue it's gone even if she does file the designation but doesn't file the application.
I know, you have the oral and, but I don't want to get into that.
Well, in the next sentence, but, I mean, it's in my brief, so.
But the point is that although this potential comes into play on his death, unless she does things before she dies, she has lost it. Now, if you think she has a right to it, then it seems losing it would be a taking. If she's entitled to it on his death, losing it because she dies would be as much a taking as not giving interest on it.
That could be an argument. However, I would say that because all of the rights are defined in the contract.
Right. She doesn't have.
She takes the benefit as it's provided by Chapter 40.
There's a precedent to this, or you can say condition subsequent or condition precedent, which knocks her out.
Right.
If she doesn't perform. And under any conditions, your view is that there's no interest. Right? Even if she's the day after death, she had everything all ready to go. She files her application. And you pay out 2.5 months later, she's not entitled to interest in
that. That's correct. That's correct. On that lump sum amount. One last point I would like to make, though, is that the plaintiff's claim for interest, and I think Justice Crooks addressed this with Attorney Elliott, is completely in opposition to the rights of the rest of the participants in the system, which was found by this court in the line of cases beginning even before Giesel but through Lightborn, which is that the participants have a right, a general property right, in their pension fund to have the payments, the benefit payments that are promised, and any other amounts paid in accordance with the statute.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Elliott?
If I make no other point to this court today, I want to make clear to the court or disabuse the court of the illusion that the ETF has created here in its argument that Mrs. Fazio received any interest whatsoever. And I ask each justice to look at page 20 of the appendix in our brief in chief, which is at the record, page 107 of the record, which is the stipulation of facts creating the class model upon which Judge Fiedler made the decision on the summary judgment motion. And I have to read some of it. Paragraph 2 of that stipulation, which it turns out actually was drafted by the state, says a lump sum special death benefit for Anthony Fazio for his designated beneficiary. It was calculated by the DETF in the amount of $507,000 as of January 3rd, 1999. Not as of any other date. Had Mrs. Fazio...
I don't think what she said was that she received interest in addition. I think what she said was there was an amount in his account. The interest kept accruing to that amount. They looked at the interest and the principal, and that's how much there was a dollar amount in the left. Then they calculated the death benefit in the right. They compared the two, and she got the greater amount. So within the greater amount... is a dollar amount sufficient to offset the interest that was in his account? At least that's how I understood her argument.
No, I, I dispute, well, maybe I misheard it, but that the fact are, if facts are as they are laid out here, and they are the same for each one of the members of the plaintiff class, that as of the date, day after the date of death, there was a lump sum special death benefit calculated as of that date. And whether the designated beneficiary applied for that benefit the next day or 2 years later, like Mrs. Fazio, that's all they got. And that amount, the $507,000, according to the state, according to the ETF stipulation, they kept in their interest-bearing accounts and earned the interest on it, and that's and then kept that interest 2 years later in Mrs. Fazio's case when it paid out the principal.
Your point is that the accruement should have continued until December 1st, 2000?
Yes, she should have received the interest on that
Fazio. Whatever everybody else got, whatever Mr. Fazio would have been entitled to as of December 1st, 2000, that's what you're arguing Mrs. Fazio should be entitled to.
No,
not sure I understand you. I'm arguing that Mrs. Fazio should be entitled to the, as Justice, Judge Fiedler applied the formula that he did, the compensation for the use that the ETF made of that $507,000 from January 3rd, 1999 until December 1st, 2000, when they actually paid it out.
How did you calculate the interest? This is what Justice Prosser asked.
How did they calculate it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the briefs. It was the formula applied in this court's decision in Wisconsin Retired Teachers. He adopted that formula to calculate for not only Mrs. Fazio, but all of the rest of the members of the plaintiff class.
Isn't it relevant what the actual earnings were? Or does that formula take that into account?
No, because this court said in Wisconsin Retired Teachers that in a takings matter, it isn't what the state gained or lost with the property that it has taken and used for the period of time. It is what the owner of the property lost.
Could have lost.
And that's why in this court adopted that formula in Wisconsin Retired Teachers, and Judge Fiedler adopted that formula as well.
Counselor, if I understand right, in the retirement death benefit as a lump sum is greater than the additive of the principal that was in his account and the interest on that through the last time interest was added to anybody's account in the state, doesn't that difference have to come from generalized money that the ETF has? I mean, didn't they supply more to her out of some funds that they control in order to pay this death benefit?
Well, that's true with all benefits. They have.
Right. So if they provided more to her than his account and his account's earnings, then how do you get away from Justice Crooks's concern? If we buy your argument, we're going to eat up those funds, and how are they going to fund future death benefits, because where are they going to get the money from?
Well, I assume that it would be, as they've always got funds, from the employer contributions and from the earnings produced by the SWIB. But I don't think that is determinative of whether or not this was a taking and whether or not the issue before this court is whether or not the designated beneficiary had a property interest in this property, in this case, from January 3rd, 1999 until December 1st, 2000.
Sure. I understand that. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Elliott, and thank you, Mr. Hickman. Yes, appreciate your arguments on one of the more complex areas that, of many complex areas that we've had to do. One reason judges and lawyers is we probably don't do too well in mathematics. Anything that's done to help us understand the employee trust fund is greatly appreciated. So thank you, Mr. Elliott. Thank you, Ms. Hamblin. And that concludes our proceedings on 2004 AP 64, Fazio versus Department of Employee Trust Fund. The court is in recess until 1:30. Those students who are remaining should stay in the courtroom. They will be joined by others, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily. We are in recess.